Always a joy for us too. All right, we're just about to get started with our Wednesday sermon, Learning the Gospel from Matthew. And that's what we're going to talk about now. All right, so we are going to be in chapter number 26 in the book of Matthew. We're going to look at verses 6 through 13. And a theme that's going to kind of come up from that section of verses is what I call waste or worship. You know, that's a question in there. And I'm going to ask you another question. Could you identify genuine worship, biblical worship, if you saw it? Now, if you grow up in a certain part of a country or a certain part of an area, your idea or definition of worship is probably going to be colored by your culture. In the Bible Belt, where I happened to live and grew up, then when a person talked about worship at church, it usually had something to do with either singing, typically some kind of physical activity as far as lifting up the hands. It could have something to do with shouting. It could have the idea behind it or the indication that someone either took off running or some type of dancing. In other words, worship, if someone says our church really worshiped yesterday, they are usually talking about some excitement that took place and people expressing it that way. That's not always the case, and I'm not down on that at all. I'm just trying to say that sometimes when we hear the word worship, or we hear that people worshiped, we're usually going to relate that to what our culture has taught us worship is. And so today we're going to look at the Bible and say that, hey, sometimes we don't always recognize genuine biblical worship when we see it. And that's going to be the case for the disciples themselves. So don't feel bad. It's just something for us to learn. I want to talk about the disciples for just a moment since I mentioned them, because they're going to play a role in our story today. And they're going to misread a genuine biblical worship. Now, the disciples are a unique group of people. Their maturity level changed, their spiritual maturity changed so much after the resurrection of Jesus Christ. These men that followed Jesus to his cross were looking for a position in his earthly kingdom. And those same men spent a lot of time, a lot of hours, arguing and debating over who's going to be the greatest in that kingdom. After the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the ascension of Jesus back into heaven, the spiritual discernment for the disciples was so much different. It was almost as night and day in the difference of their spiritual discernment. As a matter of fact, the same men that went on after the resurrection of Jesus and planted churches, evangelized much of the world, those men showed a spiritual discernment that rivals that of the Old Testament prophets. And so it's just a big contrast to the prior to Jesus' death and resurrection to those maturity and discernment afterwards. And so sometimes, like in our story today, the disciples just did not show good spiritual discernment. And by that, I mean they just misread something really bad. And we're going to talk about that today. But I want to ask you the question as we get started that you can kind of think about. Can you identify genuine worship if you see it? Now, let me say it better. Can you identify biblical worship if you see it? Again, wherever you are raised at, you're going to interpret or identify worship with what you're used to in your culture. And so if you're in a church that worship, when they talk about we really worshiped today, you're probably going to picture people that did a lot of raising the hands, crying maybe, testifying, possibly someone took off running down the aisle, maybe a lot of shouting going on, just a lot of energy in a room sometimes can be called worship. But we're going to look today and recognize that sometimes, many times, we overlook what biblical worship really is. Now, not disqualifying anything that I mentioned earlier, but it is possible to miss and not recognize true biblical worship because of the way we identify it with our culture. So let's look at Matthew chapter number 26 and verse number 6. The Bible says, "Now when Jesus was in Bethany and the house of Simon the leper. We're going to stop right there for just a second and just kind of set the stage for where we are and what Matthew's telling us. Now, this same story is going to be told by both Mark and John. And we're going to use John's gospel a little bit tonight because that is going to, he's going to fill in the gaps. He's going to fill in more details about this same event. And that's going to help us to look at it a little bit. So Matthew's just going to simply tell us now when Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. So if you just open it up and read right there, you don't really know when was that. And if you've been following, if you're reading through Matthew, you're going to be a little bit confused because Matthew has already carried us through the triumphal entry of Jesus, which was on Palm Sunday. So he's carried us through a Saturday, a Sunday, events of a Monday and a Tuesday that's taking place in this final Passover week of Jesus. And then he says, when Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. And so John's going to let us know exactly when that was. In John chapter number 12, he says, then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. So the timing of this is this last week, but it's the Saturday probably before Jesus enters into Jerusalem on a donkey, which we call Palm Sunday. And we're kind of getting ready for all of those things, but it's already clear that we're not going to be able to hold Easter Sunday services together. So we'll have to put that off to another time. But let me get back here to our story and just kind of understand that Matthew takes us up to a certain point. Then he says, now I've got to tell you what happened the Saturday before that. And so sometimes when you're telling a story to someone, you hold certain information until it's going to make the right impact. And that's sort of what Matthew does. He walks us through several days. He gets us right to a couple days before Jesus goes to the cross to die. And then he says, now I want to tell you what happened the Saturday before that. And so he's going to take us back just a little bit. Matthew also says that he was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. Now, the events that Matthew describes is, you know, Bethany is a place that Jesus went to several times. It was just outside of the city of Jerusalem. And for this last week of Passover, the main events, everything's taking place in the city of Jerusalem. And that city is packed with people. It is completely swelled up to just a crazy number of people because the Jewish males and their families and stuff would come from all around in order to be at Jerusalem for this Passover meal, this Passover time, and this sacrifice that they would have to make in the temple. So people stayed everywhere they could. And Bethany is just a few miles outside of Jerusalem, and it happens to be the hometown of some friends of Jesus, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. And so he's in that town of Bethany. He would stay there, most likely what it looks like. He stayed there this week, and he would go back and forth into Jerusalem and back and forth to Bethany several times during that week. So he spent his days in Jerusalem and a lot of his nights in Bethany. And so we're told that while he's in Bethany, he goes to a dinner party, which he is the honored guest at, and it's in the house of a man named Simon the leper. Now, leprosy is a disease that is extremely contagious with no known cure for it. And every person, therefore, that had leprosy was required to be quarantined from everybody. And they wasn't allowed to live in houses. You know, they had leper colonies outside of villages and stuff. And so it kind of reminds us of social distancing, doesn't it? And so these lepers had to be separated. So when we find that Jesus was in the house of Simon the leper, it probably does not mean that Simon was currently a leper. Most likely, Jesus has healed Simon at some point in the past, and Simon is no longer a leper. He's able to live again his life. He's able to get back into his home. He's able to go to work. He's able to be in social gatherings. He's able to go to Jerusalem and be a part of this Passover week. And so everything that had been taken away from him because of the leprosy, Jesus restored that because he's able to give him back his life that he had. So we've got to conclude that Simon was in the was no longer a leper. And Simon must also be a friend of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And they did live in the same town, so it's very possible. And let's look at what John says in his gospel again. We'll read this verse again. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. So when Jesus was in Simon's house, Jesus appears to be the guest, the honored guest at this dinner party. And the reason was, is most likely Simon is wanting to do something for the man that healed him from his leprosy. He feels eternally indebted to Jesus. Now, earlier I asked you, could you recognize biblical worship if you saw it? Does anything stand out to you so far? How about Simon having this dinner party for Jesus? You know, a dinner party was a common way to honor someone, and they still are today. And it was an act of worship. It enabled Simon to honor Jesus with his substance, with the things that he had. He was able to host this meal, provide this meal, and provide this time to honor Jesus by making him the special guest of honor in this home and in this meal. It cost him something. We may not have been a great cost, but it, you know, we don't know how many people that he hosted there. I'm not saying he spent his life savings on it, but I am saying that there was an act of worship. He wanted to bring honor to Jesus, and that's what worship is. It's appreciation, it's love, and that's what I believe Simon had. Love and appreciation for the man that had gave him back his life. And he was willing to let this act of worship cost him something. I want to say that genuine worship is costly. You know, biblical worship of God is costly. Worship is sometimes portrayed as Christians as entertainment, you know, something that pumps us up and energizes us. But worship cost people something. When David was in the Old Testament, when David had sinned and he needed to make an atonement for his sin, he's going to buy a field, and he needs a place to give the sacrifice, and there's a specific place he needs to have, but he doesn't own that land. Let's notice something. And the king, this is David, said unto Araunah, "Nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price." Now, this man offers, he's saying to David, I will not sell you my land, I'll give you this land, and I'll give you the oxen, and I'll give you everything that you need to make an offering unto God. So you can sacrifice to God, and I'll pay for everything. I'll give you the land, I'll give you those things. And David said, "I will surely buy it of thee at a price." Now, why was David insistent to buy this at a price? Notice what he says next. "Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which doth cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. So this doesn't break David in any way financially. But David recognized something. He said, "I cannot worship God if it doesn't cost me something." In other words, what he's saying is, I cannot make a sacrifice. What kind of sacrifice is it to take something that doesn't cost me anything and give it back to God? So genuine, or I really should have their biblical worship, is costly. And that is something. Now, I'm not dismissing any of the raising of hands. I'm not dismissing any of the outward acts of enjoying that type of worship experience. But what I am saying is that there's a worship that God takes notice of, that gets mistaken by people sometimes, and it's something that costs us. It's costly. And we're going to look at that a little bit as we go on today. In verse number 7 of Matthew, we're back at Matthew 26, and the verse number 7 says, "There came unto him," this is Jesus at the dinner table, "there came unto him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment, and poured it on his head, and as he sat at meat." Now, Matthew records only that it was a woman that came in and done this. Again, we're going to turn back to John and see what John says about this person that came in. Notice what it says here. Then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Now, there's a couple of things that we'll have to mention here, but I want to say once again, can you identify between worship and waste? Genuine worship is costly. Biblical worship that God takes notice of will cost you something. And we're going to talk about that more as we go. But is there an act of worship in your life that you can point back to and say, I went all in on God right there? That was my time. That was my moment. I know I went all in on God. Sometimes Christians speak of the church service and they say something like, you know, we really worship God. I mentioned that earlier. What we kind of mean sometimes is that we just got excited. And there's nothing wrong with that, because we should get excited about God. The songs that we sing should get us excited about God. I have a feeling when we go back to church and we can have church together as a church family all across America and around the world, I believe there's going to be people that's excited. And I believe there's going to be an outward expression of that excitement. There'll be testimonies and there's going to be lots of praise and there'll be worship that goes out that way. But I want to remind you that true biblical worship will cost you something. And that's what we want to look at here with Mary. So it says, there came unto him a woman, but John says that it wasn't just any woman, this was Mary. So at this dinner table, party, Lazarus is seated at the dinner table with Jesus. Martha, we are told, is serving. Now this looks very familiar to a scene we had earlier where Lazarus was there and Martha was serving and Mary sat at the feet of Jesus. And Martha comes and she fusses and says to Jesus, you know, make my sister, you know, serve with me. Don't let me have to do this alone. And so Jesus kind of told Martha then, he said, you know, you're busy about a lot of things and anxious about a lot of things, but Mary has chosen that greater part. So once again, we see these roles happening. Nothing wrong. Martha is doing her part by serving. Never, ever discount disrespect her for serving. No more than disrespecting Lazarus for sitting there. But Mary is something inside of her. She seems to have a spiritual connection with Jesus that's a little different. And she sees these opportunities as something more than serving him dinner. Something more than what's going on. And she always seems to take advantage of these opportunities. And that's what she's going to do here. So it was Mary that came in. And she anoints the head. Now John says the feet. And Matthew says the head, and what we find out is that she actually anointed his entire body, most likely. And she anointed him, we could say it this way, from head to foot. And this is not something we're used to. So let's explain it a little bit so that you'll understand what Mary was doing, why she was doing it. Anointing the head of a person with the expensive perfume was a sign of honor. It was one of the great signs of honor, sometimes done for wedding. A husband and wife, as they're getting married, and special guests at a particular thing, they were anointed with a oil, and it's a very costly oil. We're going to see that. When the Bible says it was a very precious ointment, it means it was very expensive, just really expensive. We're going to tell you in a little while just how expensive it was. So John provided more details by saying that she did not stop at his head, but went all the way to his feet. She poured out the entire contents on him. The entire contents of this bottle, she just, it may even be, and we're going to, I guess we'll try to share it this way, we can go ahead and say it now. It may be that she was originally going to pour some on him, but she just goes to an extreme with it, and I want to kind of, we'll get to that part. The reaction of the disciples, now that's interesting, but when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, to what purpose is this waste? Now, I told you earlier that they were going to interpret her act of worship as waste. Jesus is going to interpret it as worship. So the reaction from the disciples indicates that Mary had gone to an extreme when anointing Jesus. They're not just saying, why are you wasting your time trying to honor Jesus? That's not what they're saying at all. They recognize that Simon the leper is honoring Jesus and with the meal. So it's not that they're upset that she's honoring Jesus. They are shocked by the way she goes about doing it. They are shocked and taken back. And now the word indignation comes in, and that word means that there's an anger inside. You know, it just really, really rubs them the wrong way that she did what she did. And so what is it that she did? She poured this expensive ointment all over him, and she just went to an extreme. Matter of fact, there's two key words in this: indignation and waste. And so it appears that Mary just went to an extreme measure. I believe if Mary would have just come in, and you'll understand this in a little while, but if Mary just would have come in and just, you know, did a normal amount of just anointing the head of Jesus, they probably would have recognized what she was doing, would have thought it was nice and kind of her to do that, but they would not have been filled with indignation, and they would not have called what she'd done a waste. Notice in verse number 9, the Bible says, "For this ointment might have been sold." This is what the disciples are saying. I mean, why is this waste made? "For this ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor." Now, Judas is the one that's the main perpetrator in stirring up the disciples in this event. We find that from the book of John again. So Judas disguised his true purpose by claiming that he was upset that the ointment was wasted because it could have been sold and given to the poor. Now, we actually find out in the other Gospels that Judas was a thief. And so, you know, sometimes people think that Judas was just deceived, but we find out already he was a thief. We find out that long before Jesus died, Judas was already selling out, trying to get something out of the time that he had spent. Judas was looking for Jesus to establish an earthly kingdom, and he wanted a position there. He wanted to overthrow the Romans, and Judas was very, you know, becomes more and more disgruntled with Jesus that he wasn't going to do that. That's one reason he goes and sells out Jesus and sells him to the Pharisees. We'll see that coming up in the weeks ahead. Now, coming back to this, when this takes place, Judas sees an opportunity. He sees money being poured out all over the ground. He sees it being wasted, but somehow he has managed to get the rest of the disciples stirred up with him. So in John chapter number 12, verse 5, Judas estimates the cost of this ointment at 300 pence. Now that is equal to an average man's yearly wages. Did you get that? The ointment that she poured out, Judas estimates, was worth the average man, average daily worker, a year's wages. And I kind of tried to calculate that a little bit just based on our average wages today. If you kind of put into the, try to get into the mindset of the disciples as they were experiencing this, then we want to look at how much would this be worth today. And if we did an average daily worker, hourly workers, what we call them, at a minimum wage or just a little above minimum wage, somewhere in there, I figured out it would be equal to about $20,000 to $25,000. So just imagine if Mary had went in our day and time and she had got some perfume that cost $20,000 to $25,000. And then she goes and she doesn't pour out just some of that on Jesus. She just gets either caught up in all that she's doing, and she goes all in, and she ends up pouring all of it out, all the way to the fact that it's running from head to toe, and it's not an oily mess, but it does say that, you know, she even wiped his feet with the hairs of her head. That's what we find in the book of John. So it kind of lets us know that much money, a year's salary, is why the disciples had such a reaction to what they did, what Mary did. It was the fact that she had went and poured a year's worth of wages on top of Jesus to honor him, when just a little bit would have honored him. You know, just doing the normal amount would have been fine. But we kind of get the idea that Mary comes in here and, you know, she's already made this decision that she's got this ointment that she has purchased at a great price. and she's going to do something special with it, and she sees her opportunity. Now, she's actually recognizing something that the disciples don't. She's starting to recognize and believe Jesus is going to die. He's been saying that over and over. The disciples have refused to believe it and to accept it, but Mary seems to have caught on to it. And she realizes that her opportunity to do something for the man that has given her back her life is slipping away. And so she comes in with this ointment at this dinner time. She knows he's going to Jerusalem this week to the Passover, and she's probably heard him, the fact that he's going to go there, and he said he's going to go there and die. Now Mary comes in, and as she starts to pour this, it just, the emotions of it, the appreciation, she realizes, I can't just do a little. He's worthy of it all. And Mary went all in at that moment. And she let her worship just take over everything. And she just put it all aside for him. And she poured it all out. And that was what shocked the disciples. And it completely enraged Judas, because all he wanted was the money. Now, these disciples, think about what I said earlier, their spiritual discernment was really way off at this time, because they did not discern this as Jesus being worthy of this in a sense, or else they would not have been upset about it. You know, they saw Mary as going too far to an extreme with her worship. But how did Jesus see it? When Jesus understood it, he said unto them, "Why trouble ye the woman? For she hath wrought a good work upon me." Jesus interprets her actions the right way. Jesus sees exactly what she's done, and he comes to her defense. Think about Mary also at this time, because she has just gotten completely caught up in her worship with Jesus. She goes completely to the extreme. She's happy. I'm not saying she's going to regret that later at all. I'm saying she recognizes it's a conscious decision. He's worthy of this, and it had to be tough for her to do this, and she's doing it publicly. And the people that are watching her, the disciples, the ones that should have encouraged her the most in what she did, they begin to criticize her, and they begin to they're just fussing about the fact that she did it. That had to be hard for her. Think about if you used to get up in church just simply to give your testimony and to thank God, and then someone stood up and told you that that was inappropriate. That'd be hard. But what if you'd spent a year's wages doing it? What if you had done something that really cost you something, and then someone just completely criticized? You know, people don't really mind, though, if we do something for God. Some people really have a fit if people give their money to the church, and others, if it's a little bit, then that's okay. But when it really gets out of hand, then people get scared. But I want to say something. It's not just money. There's time that you can give to God. A biblical act of worship is giving up something that costs you. And Jesus recognizes what Mary did, and he honors it. And he actually goes and defends her. Now, he's going to answer the accusation of Judas from the book of John, where Judas said this could have been given to the poor, and also in Matthew he records that as well. And Jesus is going to address that statement, and it's really important, because in churches today there's always a debate between how much do we use in certain things, and how much should we be doing in outreach and ministry, and how do we use our funds properly for God. And notice this. He says, "For ye have the poor always with you, but me ye have not always." Now, Jesus addressed the false notion that money would be better spent on the poor than on worshiping God. And he's making this statement. Now, he doesn't neglect the fact. He doesn't say it's all right to neglect the poor and just spend money on lavishing the church and everything else. What he said was, you're going to always have an opportunity to take care of the poor. But the opportunity to honor him was limited. To do what she did was coming, a window was closing on that opportunity. But she would always have the opportunity. The poor was always going to be before them. I want to say this. There's going to be some times that God's going to call you to do something, and the time for him, there's going to be a window of opportunity to do it. And you can come up with 100 good reasons and other things you could do, but a lot of those things are always going to be there. And when God leads you to do something, you got to seize that opportunity. You know, if Mary had missed it on this one, she would not have got another opportunity. He says, the poor you have with you always, but me ye have not always. Again, Jesus is going to use this as an opportunity to continue teaching the disciples. I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm going to die. You know, he realizes that. He's been teaching them that, but they refuse to accept that. But Mary somehow had come to that place and she had accepted it and she had gotten it. And because of that, she does this act. Notice what he says in verse 12. For in that she hath poured this ointment on my body. Again, recognize that. I don't know if she got it through his whole body, but it appears that it went from head to toe. He said she did it for my burial. Now, here is a deeper meaning behind what she did. Jesus doesn't just say, well, she just came to worship me or she came to honor me. Mary recognizes that Jesus is going to go to Jerusalem and he's going to die. And she wants to do something about it. Matter of fact, we're going to learn later that the night that Jesus dies, he's going to be taken down hurriedly, placed into a borrowed tomb in a rush, and they're not going to have the opportunity because of the Sabbath day to anoint his body for the burial. And so Jesus recognizes that there's a deeper meaning behind what took place here. So the disciples, you know, they've been slow and reluctant to accept this, but Mary got it. I wonder what they would have done if they had realized just how close they really was to losing Jesus or for him dying. I wonder if they would have still thought that Mary's act was a waste. He says, verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this that this woman hath done be told for a memorial of her. So finally, Jesus says, you know what? Wherever the gospel is going to be preached, this woman is going to be honored with the retelling of this story for thousands and thousands of years until he comes back. I want to go back to the statement that we made earlier and bring us back into this thought of worship. Genuine worship is costly. And I want to say it the way I've been trying to go back to it. Biblical worship is costly. Now, does your definition of worship match up to the definition Jesus had here? He interpreted her act of going all in on him, all in with this expensive, costly perfume. He saw it as worship. Now, this does not mean you've got to, that Jesus is looking for you to spend all of your money on him. But I want to say that if money is a problem in your life, then you're not going to be able to truly worship him. Did you know that tithing is an act of worship? You know, giving back to God is an acknowledgement of who God is. And giving above that tithe, that's that requirement, giving that offering, that is an act of worship. One of the biggest acts of worship that we can do is come to God and give him everything relinquishing all that we have into his hands. And by doing that, we recognize, God, all that I have financially is yours. How do you want me to disperse that? And that's part of it. But also your time. You know, it costs you time to worship God. Just being in church, you know, getting up, getting ready, being dedicated, being committed for you. So let's take it this way. You're watching this video and it's going to take you about a half hour or so to watch this video. That's time that you have to set aside and you can give God your time. That's just a small portion of time. How do you spend your life? Biblical worship is costly. So the next time that you think about true and genuine worship, ask yourself, have I really ever done anything that cost me? Have I ever given to God something that really cost me everything? I want to say this, that a lot of times people, they see the person that's worshiping in different ways, but God recognizes acts of worship that take place all the time. Sometimes it's just that act of worship. He recognizes that dear elderly lady that's sitting in the church pew that physically went through a battle just to get out of bed, just to get dressed, just to get prepared and get ready. She probably started long before a lot of other people did, and she got there and she came into a building and she sat down to be in church, and she can't even get up and down all the time because of her pains, and yet she's there. And when others might be shouting or doing things, I want to say that God does not overlook her act of worship. Maybe an elderly gentleman, or maybe just a young child. Maybe a young teenager that's listening this day, you may be somebody that God recognizes your act of worship. And that could be something that doesn't even take place in the church. You're out there with your friends and those people that are not Christian sometimes, and they may push you to do something or encourage you to do something that you know is a sin, you know is not right. And you take a stand, you decide. I mean, you don't bow up about it, you don't get arrogant about it, you just back out of the situation some way. And not being popular with them, not being, or risking being made fun of, that's going to cost you something. Did you know that's an act of worship as well? And it does not go unnoticed by God. I could go on all night about what acts of worship would look like. But whatever you do, I promise you, whatever you do that costs you something, that you do it for the honor of God and the honor of Jesus Christ, it is an act of worship and it pleases God well. So I want you to think about that this week, and I want you to do something else. Worship God this week. Worship Him by saying, God, what is it that I can let go of? What is it that I can relinquish? What is it that I can do or not do that will be a great act of worship for you? Until we meet again,